Grab your beverages and turn up your interweb. Solving the world's problems 12 ounces at a time. It's Dudes and Beer. Well, hello everybody, and welcome to this episode of the Dudes and Beer podcast. I am Chris Jordan, your host. Welcome to all of our new listeners in the Hudson Valley on WMLD. Great to have all of y'all here helping solve the world's problems 12 ounces at a time. So excited for our guest tonight. Before we get into that, don't forget, the Dudes and Beer podcast is now brought to you by Audible. If you're a fan of books like I am and just don't have time to turn a page, Audible is the choice for you. Stop on by audibletrial.com/dudesandbeer to get your free 30-day trial of Amazon's Audible today. Tons of genres, tons of books. Check it out. Our guest this evening, Joe Castro, an amazing special effects designer, director of horror films galore, will be our guest talking about the world of horror movie makeup. This is really what brought me into the industry that I work in, everybody. I am so excited for this episode this evening. Before we get into that, let's check out this week's report from our in-house reporter, John Bound of Daily News Collective.
California Governor Gavin Newsom recently expanded anti-Second Amendment legislation despite the fact that the gun homicide rate is down over the last 25 years, even with the high-profile mass shootings plaguing America.
But when 3 of the 10 deadliest shootings in American history, in our 240-year history, have come in the last 5 months, let me say that again, 3 of the 10 deadliest shootings in American history have come in the last 5 months. Mika, we are in the midst of an epidemic.
Newsom gave teeth to a red flag law that now allows co-workers, employers, and educators to file for gun violence restraining orders that last up to 5 years against gun owners they deem a danger to themselves and others. The same legislation was vetoed twice by former ultra-progressive Governor Jerry Brown. Newsom's legislation also gives judges the ability to issue search warrants as they grant the orders. Meaning, if a gun owner is served with a relinquishment order but fails to turn over the firearms or ammunition, the warrant can be activated immediately. Fox News reported the ACLU says the bill poses a significant threat to civil liberties because a restraining order can be sought before a gun owner has an opportunity to dispute the request. Additionally, those making a request under the new law may lack the relationship or skills required to make an appropriate assessment. Newsom went on to boast that California has outperformed the rest of the nation.
California has outperformed the rest of the nation because of our gun safety laws in reducing the gun murder rate substantially compared to the national reduction. Let me be specific and precise. Between 1993 and 2017, these are the latest numbers we have. We'll get the 18 numbers in shortly. There's been a 62% decline in the gun murder rate in the state of California compared to just 34% nationwide. That's because of the leadership of the state in gun safety laws. No state does it as well or comprehensively as the state of California, and we still have a long way to go.
But is it due to Newsom's unconstitutional tyranny? In Texas, where you can take a handgun to your college class, gun regulations have been rolled back, yet its gun homicide rate has plummeted 61% in the last quarter century. Democratic Assemblyman Phil Ting of San Francisco, who authored the bill, claimed a study found that gun restraining order laws may have helped prevent 21 mass shootings, yet the UC Davis researchers warned that it's impossible to know whether violence would have occurred. Ting also authored a companion bill that would allow gun owners who are the subjects of restraining order requests to file a form with the court declaring that they won't contest the requests and are surrendering their firearms. Currently, even those who agree to give up their guns must go through a constitutional court hearing. Apparently, the Second Amendment no longer exists in California, making it a prime destination for home invasions, carjackings, and full-blown chaos.
A frightening night for people living in this East Lake neighborhood after a home invasion robbery.
Family who's blurred out in this video is held at gunpoint for an hour as mass thieves ransacked their home.
Criminals that are now locked up, six in all and all young, connected to a string of home invasions that terrorized the North County.
Lodi are searching for a suspect in connection with a homicide and home invasion robbery that left a 26-year-old man dead.
The two robbers walking around through the downstairs. This happened at 10:55 in the morning last Friday.
Immediately, the suspects forced their way into the residence and began assaulting the victim.
The horrifying home invasion happened in a matter of seconds. Two thieves burst through the door and are seen dragging an elderly man across the living room.
One of the guys just grabbed him and tore him, asked him, "Where's the money? Where's all the money?"
Here, open his door. Open his door.
A carjacker broke into the driver's seat of their minivan and took the keys, but a group of bystanders jumped in to stop him.
Wild night here. It begins with a carjacking and pistol whipping of an elderly woman. And then today, around 3 o'clock, the suspects were spotted here in Broadmoor near Daly City, and police spent most of the evening trying to track them down.
Just a circus almost for the area. There you go. I'm sure that's what the commands are, and then the commands are also going to be on your belly.
John Bound reporting.
Audio you are listening to is the amazing trailer for The Summer of Massacre, a movie by Joe Castro and Steven Escobar that actually earned Joe the acclaim of the amazing Guinness Book of World Record title of the highest body count in any slasher film, of 155 bodies taken during the making of that. And that is just, as an old school reader of Fangoria magazine and lover of all things gore, that's just a beautiful title to hold. Welcome to the show, Joe Castro. How are you doing today, sir?
I'm doing amazing. Thanks for having me on the show, Christopher.
Absolutely. That is, I've already got it on my list of things to watch before I leave town. I'm going to be watching it tonight after my show. I always love a good 10 p.m. horror movie watch. But I cannot wait to watch what is apparently the slasher film of slasher films, The Summer of Massacre.
It is. It is. I got, we hold the title for the Guinness Book of World Record for the highest body count in a slasher movie. And, you know, when I made that film with my partner, Steven Escobar, at the time I was learning computer generated effects, here in Burbank, California, at a school. And so that film was like my test run of computer generated effects. I did all the effects myself. My partner edited the film. And I wrote it and directed it. And we had a friend of ours named Schroeder who helped us get the body count really high. And basically, you know, when you watch the film, it's not your typical slasher movie. It's very stylized and it has a very artistic feel to it. And like I said, I was learning at the time I did the film with computer generated effects. There are practical effects in the movie, but the computer generated effects in the film really are the big part of the big show, you know.
Okay.
The
okay.
blood and the gore. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, let's backtrack. I guess really a couple few decades here, Joe, because a lot of this show is about people's stories. How did you, like myself being a live AV engineer, I always accredit Tom Savini. Anytime I see him in the news, I always post it on social media and thank him for my career, because it was my want to do horror movie makeup that took me into theater, that then took me into technical theater, and then eventually into running sound for bands, doing AV, all that kind of stuff, and into the career that I now have and the success that I have. But it was my want to do what it is that you do, special effects makeup, things like that, that really captured my imagination with movies and that kind of stuff. How was it that you came to be involved in the industry? When did you first catch the special effects bug?
Well, that is a very good question. When I was 7 years old, it was 1977, they used to have these Saturday afternoon creature features. And every Saturday afternoon on one of the major networks, they would play, you know, basically like a Japanese monster movie or like a Universal monster movie. And my father was babysitting me. It was a weekend where my mother was away on a vacation trip with her friends, and my father was out doing work on the ranch. We grew up in I grew up on a goat ranch in Helotes, Texas, and my father was out on the ranch working, and he didn't want me to get hurt out in the yard, so he put me in front of the television, and he said, "Watch this movie; you're gonna love it." And it was the first time I'd ever actually watched a movie by myself. It was Godzilla versus the Smog Monster.
Sweet.
And at the time I was really, really interested in becoming a paleontologist, which is, you know, someone who digs up dinosaur bones. So I had a big fascination for dinosaurs and dragons. So my father knew naturally that I would love Godzilla. And sure enough, when that movie was over, I knew exactly what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. I wanted to make monsters and special effects for the motion picture industry, and hopefully also direct them. And you know, here we are. Let's see. I want to say about 43 years later. That's exactly what I'm still doing, chasing that dream.
Yeah, and you know, like we were talking about before the show, it's that passion that keeps you going. I don't understand. Like I was saying, I don't understand the curmudgeons in our industry, the people that are so salty that you almost don't want to be with them on set or on a job site. Like, they do a great job, and you can't deny the great job that they do, but it's one of those like, oh, great, they're going to be here, you know?
I will tend to take a compassionate side for some of them, because maybe they've been stepped on picked on and poked at, you know, throughout their upcomings in the industry. But also, you know, I have the attitude that everything must meet a certain criteria if my name is attached to it these days. And, you know, I absolutely 100% am a team player and like to collaborate with the director in all aspects of my work. I never like to be like, well, here, this is what you get. I like to really co-collaborate with the director and the producer, but there are some people that don't have that. They don't have that perspective, you know, and they're still struggling and fighting to make their way up. Still struggling and fighting to make a name for themselves. And I can see where they would be guarded, but, I've been doing it for a long time. So I kind of put all that aside. And it hasn't been that long. It was maybe about 5 years ago when my whole perspective changed on why I'm doing what I'm doing and who I'm doing it for and what makes it all worthwhile.
Yeah. And, you know, it was probably right up around the same time for me where things really started to take on the concept of, I looked at it much more of a career. And it was probably about 8-9 years ago, something like that. when I finally just decided, like, no, this is what I do. Like, it's how I define myself. I had a day job and I was still mixing at night here and there, stuff like that. But I didn't define myself by my day job. I defined myself by what I did after I got out of work every day. And I was like, wow, that's a different concept than I've ever been taught to think. How come nobody ever told me to think that way? Like, that just naturally came out that, well, I'm an audio engineer, but this is what I do during the day, you know?
Yeah, I mean, when I was raised in Texas, I kind of feel like my upbringing was, let me teach Joe what he needs to know to do what I need him to do. And that really didn't put me in a position where I was pointed in the right direction for what my dreams were.
Yeah.
And I had to leave Texas to come out to Los Angeles and be surrounded by people that were pursuing the same career. And I have a new family out in LA. You know, I mean, there are people out here in LA that I work with and that I've known for decades that I consider closer than my actual blood relatives, you know. Some people might take offense to that, but it's true. I mean, these people have been there for me for years and years and decades. And I actually don't talk to anybody in my family anymore. There's very few people I talk to. They have their own life and their own careers, and most of them never pursued their dreams. In fact, almost all of them, you know, they compromised and they stayed at home and they took the sure way, which is great. You know, if that makes you happy. But that was, my dad knew that I would never be happy with that. And so when I was 18 years old, before I left the house to come out to Los Angeles, my dad looked at me in the eye and he said, Joe, I want you to promise me that you will never stop chasing your dream to be a special effects artist. And I made that promise to him right then and there. And my dad passed away in 1997 of a massive heart attack, and he had a car accident about a quarter of a mile from the house. And to this day, I never let him down. I would never stop chasing the dream. So there you go.
Good for you, man, because that is literally what it takes. It's no different than trying to chase the raise at work or trying to chase the next position up the totem pole. It is the want to do it. It is the drive to want to do it that makes success. And you really do have to define success in your own way. And for your father to encourage you to do that, to encourage, which doesn't come often in Texas, being a Texan myself.
You're absolutely right.
It's much more the fact of, like, so you're going to work as a pipe fitter, right? You know,
that's right. You're absolutely right.
You're going to go out and you're going to get the job. And that's what you're going to do. To follow something like that, to follow a pursuit, especially along those lines, because, yeah, I heard it for so long whenever you're done chasing wires on Friday and Saturday night, let me know. Maybe I can help you find a job or something.
That's right.
And
yeah, I get it.
You know, it's interesting that now what was once a hobby, had somebody told me, like, hey, just kind of point a little bit of that energy over here and you'll be amazed what happens. How did you first land into the industry? What was your barrier for entry, Joe? How did you first step in?
When I was 15 years old, I entered a national special effects makeup contest that was put on by the number one sci-fi magazine in the United States at the time, and it was the editor was Forrest J. Ackerman. Now, if you don't know who Forrest J. Ackerman is, you need to know. Your education in the world of science fiction horror films is incomplete. Forrest J. Ackerman was the very first horror sci-fi groupie ever. And how do we know that? Because he is the first person to ever have a magazine that boasts movies that were coming out. They got readers to read it. You know, they got science fiction nerds together. They got horror nerds together. And the magazine was called Famous Monsters of Filmland. And he started up a new magazine called Monsterland, and he put together a contest in it. And Monsterland magazine said, make a special effect and have it judged by the likes of John Carl Beekler, and who's the director of like Friday 13th, 7. He did the movie Ghoulies, Troll, and then Joe Dante, of course, you directed Gremlins and directed The Howling and so many other amazing films. So Joe Dante and John Carl Beekler picked my special effects makeup entry, and I won the contest, the national contest. And part of the winning prize was that they flew me out to Los Angeles. I was 15 years old. I think it was it was either a freshman or a sophomore in high school, and I think it was my freshman summer. And they flew me out to Los Angeles, where I met Joe Dante and Sean Carl Beekler and a whole bunch of people, like Doug Beswick, who worked with Rick Baker. I met Brink Stevens, an amazing scream queen who has been in over 200 films now, and she is one of my best friends. She lives like, you know, a mile and a half from me here in Los Angeles. I met Portia Ackerman. I went to the Ackerman Mansion. You know, I got to see all kinds of amazing things on my trip. And I had a foundation of who to come back to when I came to L.A. You know, and the minute I graduated from high school, I worked like one job in San Antonio. Actually, two or three short-lived jobs, 1 month here, 1 month there. And then when I turned 19, I came out to Los Angeles.
You know, oh, wow. So
continue chasing your,
You went straight out. That is...
Yeah.
That's wild. Like, most of the people I know from the Texas area, most people that end up going to LA, stuff like that, it's like a mid-20s thing, you know, where they finally just go, I'm going to do it. At like 25, 26 years old. Let's put it this way.
I was 19 years old the first year I lived in Los Angeles. It was 19. I came out here in October of 89. But by October of 1990, I had already had 9 different roommates from Texas.
Wow.
Because they had all come and gone back, and come and gone back, and gone back. Yeah. Because, you know, they couldn't make it. They couldn't take it, you know. Go ahead.
I was going to say, how was your acclimation? Because, you know, I mean, culture's a little bit different, but pace of life is totally different. Just the industry itself and how to go about meeting people, things like that.
Well, you know, it was, I had a connection to people here. So when I came out, I had some people that I could talk to, but I had a plan when I came out here. I had enough money in my pocket for first and last month's rent. And I had, some spending cash, and I had some phone numbers. And I knew after the first 2 weeks, I came out here to get a, I was promised work at a special effects company when I drove out here. And when we got here, of course, the boss of that company said, oh, the job fell through. We don't have any work for you.
Yeah.
So immediately I went to work at Universal Studios, theme park in the park. And I was picking up cigarette butts there. Within 2 weeks, I got a job working on a movie set as a production assistant. And I was being paid like $200 a day, you know, in 1989, wow. $200 a day is great money. So I left Universal, and I immediately started my career into the world of independent filmmaking. You know, I worked with people like Brink Stevens and Fred Olen Ray and Grant Waldman, who directed Teenage Exorcist and a whole bunch of other fun films. And then everything just kind of barreled up from there, you know. And became a working special effects artist, and then finally one of my executive producers of one of the productions I was working on came up with the financing to shoot my first feature, you know, and we shot a feature film, and this is when it was shot on film. This is a 35mm Panavision.
We shot
a movie titled Ceremony at the time, and I was honored and grateful to have Forrest J. Ackerman go back to the man who started that magazine. We had Forrest J. Ackerman star in the film, the editor of that Monster magazine.
Wow.
And you may say, well, who is this Forrest J. Ackerman guy? Not only did he create the very first sci-fi horror magazine ever, he also coined the phrase sci-fi.
Yeah.
So he owns the phrase sci-fi. They just say owns the phrase. That's why the Sci-Fi Network doesn't spell it sci-fi. They spell it with an S and a Y.
Yeah.
And so he has Flores molded and sculpted and shaped and is responsible for many, many people's careers, you know. And he passed away in the early 2000s, but his legacy still lives on today. And I remember meeting him for the first time at his mansion, and he actually had a vial of blood left over, a little glass bottle of blood from the original black and white version of Dracula.
Wow.
The stars Bela Lugosi. And he used to go back onto the Universal backlot and hang out on the movie set of these monster films while they were being filmed. So that's how much of an influence he had on the world of horror and science fiction. And Flory was in my very first film. It's titled Ceremony. It was shot on 35mm Panavision. And Steve Gaynor was my director of photography, my co-producer. And that was 1993. We shot that. And since then, I've produced and directed 18 feature films. And all of them with a worldwide distribution, and it's been a great ride. You know, it's been a great ride.
Yeah, I was going to say your IMDb is insanely long. It is varied with titles. I mean, all the way to like Uncle Sam, things like that. But
right,
great titles, stuff that I know I've heard of. Especially the Terror Toons stuff. Loved that. Xenophobia. What was it like for you to start out in not just special effects, but in horror, back in those days and to where it is now? It's always been probably, you know, next to, and I don't know if you can really consider pornography film. I guess maybe at one point you could have, but not necessarily that so much. But horror is probably the most prolific genre of film that there is as far as number of titles released per year. What has it been like for you to be involved with projects like Sleepaway Camp 2, that kind of stuff? As well as the smaller
Sleepaway Camp 2, that my involvement in it was simply they did a reboot of it or re-release of it. And what happened was the director that was putting together this new reboot managed to shoot a new opening scene for the film. And in the opening scene, someone died. So he invited me to come and do the special effects for this this new shoot, and the scene was simply inserted into the opening of the film, and it came off really well. So I was honored to be hired onto that, and that was my little involvement in that. But basically, you know, back in the 90s when I was working in Los Angeles in horror, a lot of films were, you know, they didn't really have theatrical releases then. You know, all the big budget films, the studio films were getting theatrical releases. And so I worked on a lot of stuff that was strictly shot on film, but was only going to be released to the home video market, VHS, and then later DVD. But, you know, I really didn't think much about it at the time. You know, Uncle Sam was a sleepy cult film. It really didn't pick up until the early 2000s, even maybe just a decade ago. No one even knew about it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Night of the Demons 3 was a complete miss when it came out. I don't remember anybody talking about it. Now it's part of this amazing franchise, this amazing trilogy that everybody loves.
Yep.
And, you know, I was involved with, like, the remake, the television remake of Humanoids from the Deep. And I just had a little part in that. But I'm very grateful to have been able to be a part of all these genre classics. But I tend to, like, make my own stuff I like to make truly original material, you know, and so that's why we made the Terror Toons franchise back in the early 2000s. And Terror Toons was the most successful micro budget film of the year when it came out to a Blockbuster home video. We shot the entire movie for $2,300, and it was eight copies of it on DVD and 8 copies of it on VHS were in every Blockbuster in America. And, you know, since then it's made 3 sequels and wow. It's done very well and has a really nice a fan base. I'm very proud of the film. Yeah.
Yeah. And
so if anybody wants to check it out, it's called Terror Toons, and the Toons is spelled like a cartoon, T-O-O-N-S. It's a movie about killer cartoons, but it's not animated. It's live action.
Yeah. And very well done. Very amazingly written. What is the process that you go through, for I guess special effects creation first before we get into film, because that in and of itself is such an artistic palette. Do you start with sketch? Do you start just sculpting? How does your process work?
Well, you know, I talk with the director about it first. You know, and the director normally has a very clear vision of what they want. I'm kind of like in a position now where I'm working on films where, you know, I tend to understand that the director has a vision that needs to be fulfilled. A lot of people, when they come into the industry, they want to prove themselves and they want to be stand out, and they have their own style and they have their own intentions basically. And that's not the way it is. That's not the way the world works. When you're working on a movie, when I'm working on a film, the director has the only intention that needs to be accomplished. And that's why I tend to find like all these artists, amazing artists out there. They're amazing sculptors and amazing painters and amazing people that work in the industry. But very few of them work consistently because they have their own intentions attached to their work. Mm. And what I've come to understand is that the director has a vision that needs to be fulfilled and needs to be extracted from his mind, and we are there to build and create exactly what he needs in order to make the vision happen. If not, it's like, you know, having 10 different people make tomato bisque, you know, and everybody has their own little interpretation of what they should put into it. Tomato bisque is very simple. It's sour cream, tomato sauce, or tomato, and a very few ingredients.
Yeah,
you could ruin it if you put your own spin on it, and somebody else puts their own spin on it at the same time, and so I'm always there to ensure that the director gets what he needs, and to make sure that the director is happy, because my job is to make the director look cool. That's what my job is on set.
Yeah,
and so I like to work closely with the director when it comes to creating things. Yes, I have my own style, but I offer it when it's necessary, but it's not my intention now when I walk in on a movie set.
And when did you find that switch flipped for you? At what point in your career did that start happening?
That started happening back in like 2012. I was on a reality television show. It was a special effects competition show. And what I found out after being on that show was that the artists that were on the show weren't really ever going to go anywhere. They weren't ever going to pursue a career in special effects. And even if they tried, they would fail because they all had their own deviant intentions attached to what they were doing. Mm. And they were sabotaging each other and they weren't working together as a team. And that's not the way it works in the studio world. That's not the way it works on a movie set.
Yeah.
We are team players and we get the job done. Regardless of whether or not I like the director has no bearing whatsoever on the quality of work I give them.
That's right. That's right.
There's none whatsoever, you know?
Yeah.
And people don't understand that. People don't get that, you know? People with... highly sensitive personalities, like most artists, and so they cut their own feet off, you know, and so I saw this when I was on this reality TV show. I saw this happening, and I realized that it did not matter what happened with this show or whatever. That out in the real world, we must be team players, and we must behave in a manner that is befitting of the director's vision.
Yeah.
I always go back to that, you know. because the director does have a vision. Whether or not you like it is not of no relevance either. You know,
yes.
Somewhere on this planet, someone loves a movie that we do not like.
Yeah.
A movie either entertains the person who's watching it or it doesn't. There are no good or bad movies. It's the same way with work. You know, the director has a vision. You must accomplish it. How do we go about doing that? We do that by communicating with the director in the best way we know how, keeping them in the loop at all times. I'm constantly text messaging my director when I'm making something, constantly showing him pictures, constantly giving him reference, constantly sure. asking him what he would like to do next, what color he likes, this and that. I mean, unless I have a sure, I can offer a suggestion, but normally I really, really want their input. You know, two heads are absolutely better than one.
Or unless you're the director.
Unless I'm the director, yeah. But even then, I'd like to turn to my producer, you know.
Oh, sure.
And ask him, even then, I will always, you know, I've been with my partner, Steven Escobar, for 21 years, and we've made 12 movies together. Excuse me.
Wow.
And I will.
Wow.
He'll be on the couch taking a nap or getting ready for bed, and I'll be out in the studio and in the back in the garage, and I'll say, I need you to come take a look at something before I move forward. I need some help to make a decision. I still need that additional input. You know, the details are great, but the big picture is, you know, especially when you just step away from your work and take a look at it. It's great to have a second opinion. Especially if we're both working on the same project and we both have the same intentions. And I'd like to talk a little bit about a couple of other people in my life.
Yeah.
That are very influential. Of course, Steven Escobar, my partner and co-executive producer, who I've been with, you know, without him, Steve is so commercial. You know, he works on The Amazing Race. He's worked on a Big Brother, the television series, for many seasons. And he can take the most surreal, stylized director's vision and turn it into a very commercial piece of entertainment for national broadcasting, you know. And that's a real gift, because there's a lot of obscure visions and ideas out there. And yeah. to be able to take something very obscure and bizarre and surreal and uncommercial and make it commercial is a true, true gift. And he's been very influential in my life. Of course, I mentioned the Scream Queen, Brink Stevens, who I try to cast in every one of my films. And she's I consider her a sister. And she, you know, if anybody doesn't know who Brink Stevens is, you should Google her and watch some of her films. She's constantly working, and she's an amazing artist. And Steven and I actually gave her or asked her to write and direct and produce her very first film. This was back in 2012. And it took us a while to put it together, the whole idea, because it's a beautiful masterpiece. But hopefully we'll have it released before the end of next year. And it's called Personal Demons. And then I'd also like to mention Thomas Churchill. Thomas Churchill is a director and a good friend of mine that I've been working with now for 3 years. And we have three feature films coming out in the next year together.
Oh, wow.
One of them is Nation's Fire, which is an action kind of biker, gangster kind of film. And I created a lot of gore and special effects for that film. And then there's two other films. I can't divulge the titles, but one of them is a vampire film. It's also attached to a haunted franchise. Like it's a little clue that almost might give away what it's
Ooh.
About. And then there's a giant creature feature that we made together. Kind of like, when I say giant creature feature, I mean like something like Jaws, like a giant creature attacking
yeah,
people.
Yeah.
It's not a movie in the water, but it is. The creature's mouth is about as big as the Jaws creature. I'm just going to leave that at that. I can't say any more details about it.
All right.
It. But so that's something to look out for. And then lastly, I'd always like to mention Herschel Gordon Lewis. Herschel Gordon Lewis passed away 3 years ago. And Herschel Gordon Lewis is the godfather of gore. And if anybody knows who that is or doesn't know who that is, your world in education is the world of blood and splatter and horror movies is incomplete. You need to go watch one of his movies. If you've ever seen that movie Juno, people who are not interested in horror films, I say, yeah, did you see that movie Juno? They say, yeah, I saw that movie Juno. And one day, didn't it win the Academy Award the year it came out? I think it did.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. Maybe it was nominated. Anyway, Juno, in the movie Juno, this young woman is seducing a married man in the film. And she asked him, have you ever seen The Wizard of Gore in the film? And he says, no. She says, "You? What do you mean you've never seen The Wizard of Gore?" Well, that is a film directed by Herschel Gordon Lewis. And in the film, she shows him The Wizard of Gore. So if you've never seen a Herschel Gordon Lewis movie and you think you love horror films, you're way behind. You need to get with it. You need to go rent when it was getting to really get with it. So Herschel directed the very first slasher movie ever. And most people don't know this. So tell me if this sounds familiar. A deranged killer stalks innocent victims one by one, murdering them each in a horrific on-screen death, only to be killed by the hands of the hero or the heroine of the movie in an even more horrific death at the end of the movie.
Hmm.
Does that sound familiar? Does that sound familiar?
Not offhand to me.
No, just the storyline itself. Yeah. Does that sound familiar?
Oh, yeah.
That's because that's the very first slasher movie ever. That's the movie he did. So that's what I'm saying is that storyline he invented.
Yeah, that
so
formula.
Every slasher movie, yeah. So every slasher movie that you've ever seen that fits that formula comes from Herschel's movie, Blood Feast, which is the very first slasher movie ever made. It was made back in 1963, and it was shot in color. And he invented the good blood, on-screen blood, red blood, for that color movie. Before that, blood was only depicted in black and white,
yeah.
You know, using chocolate syrup. And Herschel made a blood formula for his film. And when he shot this movie, it was considered pornographic because it was had gore and blood in it. And none of the studios would pick it up and distribute it. And the only way for his movie to get seen was he had to take a 35mm print. And he would drive from city to city, the major cities, and he'd rent out adult porno houses on Sundays for the matinee. And he'd advertise in the paper and have people come see it.
Wow.
And but it's a staple today. It's the very first slasher movie ever. And it's still out there in the world. He's made many films. The Wizard of Gore, The Gore Gore Girls, The Gruesome Twosome, 2000 Maniacs. Either way, he was a man that influenced me. And I had the opportunity to make the special effects for the sequel to Blood Feast back in 2001.
Oh, wow.
It's called Blood Feast 2. So 33 years later, he made the sequel to that film, that very first original slasher movie, and I was honored to create special effects for it. And he then divulged and told me in secrecy the blood formula for his very first slasher movie ever, which I now am honored to say I'm the keeper of the blood formula for the very first blood ever used in color red motion picture cinema in a slasher movie,
which is epically awesome to have been past that mantle and have that information. That's like having the secret recipe to KFC, folks.
Exactly.
Like you may as well know how to make Coke, not real Coke. We don't want any real Coke.
Right.
New Coke, just Coke.
right. Right.
And with that in mind, you were actually telling me the other day, pre-interview, that you were doing some exciting work in the realm of Italian zombie makeup right now. I am a huge fan of Lucio Fulci. You said that you had some workshops, things like that, that you were putting on in the realm of like live demonstrations that you were doing.
Well, there's this thing I like to do when I go to sci-fi horror conventions. I like to do this thing called Italian Zombie Makeover. And basically what I do is I put on a show. It's not really a makeup demo because it's like watching, you know, Jackass. Please do not attempt this at home. You know, only industry professionals can do this. Basically what I do is I pull someone from the audience, someone who has no idea what's going to happen to them, but they agree to it. And I kind of strip them down completely and put them in like very little. And I dress them from head to toe as an Italian zombie, like from a 1970s or 80s horror film, using very similar, if not the actual same materials that are used in those films to create an Italian zombie.
Oh, wow.
And because I grew up on 70s and 80s zombie flicks, I know primarily the materials and the concepts that they use to make those things. And I use a lot of household products that they had access to in that day to make zombies with, and it's pretty crazy. I can do a person from head to toe in like 20 minutes, and it's craziness. You know, it's like watching a mad scientist work. It's a lot of fun. I have a blast doing it. It's a complete rush, and the person that's getting it done to them has no idea what's happening. It's happening so fast, and they're transformed into this amazing, hideous creature. And of course, everybody wants to have their picture taken with it when it's done. But it's a really cool show, and I'd like to. It's one of my favorite things to do. So if anybody out there has a horror con or horror convention and they want to have me do this show for them, please contact me at facebook.com/joe.castro. You can contact me there, and I'd be more than happy to come over to the con and put on a show for you guys.
Oh, I've got people for you, Joe, believe me. And, you know, one of the things that I personally have to ask, having been in the industry as long as you have, and having learned the art of digital effects, which brings things to a whole new playing ground, a whole new world of possibilities.
That's right.
Are you more analog or digital? Which one do you prefer?
Well, see, I have a huge box of tools now. Is basically what's happened. I have a whole new toolbox, a much bigger toolbox than most practical or digital artists have. I have them both. And so what I do is I build everything practical. And where my work needs improvement, I use my digital. And I can finesse my work, and I can make it look completely flawless and seamless. Great. And in some cases, I can make my practical, my digital look more practical, my practical look more digital if I need be, or, you know, I tend to start with everything digital these days, and whatever I need to do to finesse it or fix it or change it or alter it or enhance it in any way the director or myself see fit, then I can do that. But it's nice to have the knowledge of both. And I need, you know, as a visual effects supervisor, which is primarily my position, people hire me to supervise anything that's a visual and effective in their film. I need to have the working knowledge of both so I can know, I can have the knowledge of what we have access to in order to make it the best quality product that it needs to be.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it changes the game entirely as far as project scope, timetables, budget. Everything.
That's right.
Especially as a producer, director, things like that, you do have to have at least a basic understanding of these things.
That's right.
In order to play in a modern realm, anyway.
Yeah, and also to be the devil's advocate of what should be done, what should not be done, and where and when to spend money, you know, on what we see on the screen, you know.
Yeah.
A lot of people get, you know, go into a project believing that it has to be done a certain way, and they get out the other end and realize they have a whole new set of responsibilities digitally to improve their film. And, you know, there goes another large chunk of their budget because they didn't shoot it right, because they didn't, they didn't gather the materials appropriately, you know?
Well, and so, the fact is, yes, you can do it in post, but there are things that you have to do on set in order to like make that work.
That's right.
You know, you can't just hand a bunch of footage with green in the background to somebody and say, here, do your magic. There's much more. There are still practical things that go along with that.
You can, but it's going to cost you a lot more than you think.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's going to be a lot more on the back end.
Right. It costs a lot more. Yeah, that's right.
And
that's right.
With that in mind, I have a randomly geeky question for you. I don't know how much you follow the news, but I'm sure that you have heard the remarks as of late from the great Martin Scorsese about Marvel movies, things like that. I myself, as you can tell, I'm just a very large child. At 44, I'm really just 2 4-year-olds. And I love them. They're great. The same way that I loved Friday the 13th and Nightmare on Elm Street and movies like Mother's Day and things like that, and Zombie by Lucio Fulci when I was in junior high and high school and that kind of stuff. No, they are not like swaths of storytelling like Raging Bull. But to say that they aren't art, I don't know about that. I don't know about that. I think it discounts a lot. Especially myself being a comic book fan, comic books are one of the true American art forms. And one of the first things that was ever done in comics, aside from Westerns, was horror. So it's like, to me, they're innately intertwined.
Well, he definitely has a right to his own perspective.
Sure.
And that's all it really is.
Once again,
we go back to whether or not a movie is good or bad. You know, somewhere on this planet, someone literally worships a movie that we would never watch twice.
Yeah.
You know, and vice versa.
Yep.
So the movie either entertains the person who's watching it or it doesn't. You know, there is no black and white. It takes all the colors in the crayon box in order to make this world go round. And it's a matter of opinion and taste. And, you know, that's really all I have to say about that.
So,
Barney has a right to his own professional and personal opinion about things. And, you know, I'll be honest with you, I don't think I've seen his last two or three films. And like Steven Spielberg, I haven't seen his last two or three films. But I grew up on his movies, and everybody kind of evolves and changes, and, you know, and I respect them.
You're kind of busy making a lot of films.
Yeah. I'm on an amazing deadline of working, with, a very talented director. His name is Justin Seaman. And, he is directing and producing a brand new, the sequel to his 2015 smash hit, The Barn. He's doing The Barn 2 right now. And it's how do I explain it? It's like the Walt Disney of slasher horror Halloween films.
Okay.
And, it has a lot of gore in it, and it's got a lot of great stuff, zombies and witches and ghouls and goblins. And, I've been honored to recreate the three lead villains from the first film for the sequel. And, I've been working with him for almost 8 months now, and the shooting has already begun. And so I'm done with the first two villains, and I have a deadline to get the third villain done before the end of this month. And I'm on a major crunch. So I have to get out to the studio and continue moving forward with the third villain.
Well, yeah. As we let you go here, please do tell everybody where they can go online to check out your work, where they can go if they're looking for a video effects supervisor for an upcoming project, anything like that.
Well, I'd like to invite everybody to come over and say hello to my Facebook page, which is facebook.com/joe.castro. Send me a private message and say hello along with a friend request. My Instagram account is joe_castro_director. And I'd like to invite everybody to check out our brand new movie. If you like sci-fi with a little bit of a horror twist, it is Xenophobia, spelled Z-E-N-O, phobia. And it's out right now at every Walmart in America. And you can get it online from Amazon, Walmart online, and all the home media platforms. If you like 80s sci-fi horror, you're going to love this film. It has all practical alien special effects, and it's got this is actually the very first alien abduction anthology movie. So once again, I'm going back to like doing truly original work. This is the very first one ever made, the very first alien abduction anthology movie. So if you like anthology horror and you like anthology films and you like sci-fi, you're going to really love this movie.
All right. Well, I cannot wait.
Very cool.
That sounds super, super awesome. As we let you go, please do hold the line real quick as we close out.
While you're online checking out all of Joe's great work, make sure to stop on by Dudes and Beer Podcast. That is where you can find all the episodes. That is where you can find the Knowledge Vault. That's where you can find all of the great guests that we have on regularly. Make sure to tune in to WMLD if you are in the Hudson Valley. Until next time, everybody.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Dudes and Beer Podcast. To listen to our audio streams or chat with us live, download the official Dudes and Beer app for Android and iDevices, available on Google Play and iTunes markets. For more episodes, content, and information, visit us online at dudesandbeer.com. You can also find our episodes on Breach.tv, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, SoundCloud, iTunes, YouTube, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Dudes and Beer is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more about our sponsors and other podcasts on this network, visit hcuniversalnetwork.com. Thanks for listening, everybody. And until next time, drink responsibly.